Welcome to Friends and Fiction, four New York Times bestselling authors' endless stories. Novelists Mary Kay Andrews, Kristen Harmel, Christy Woodson Harvey, and Patty Callahan Henry are four longtime friends with more than 70 published books between them. Together, they host Friends and Fiction, with author interviews and fascinating insider talk about publishing and writing, to highlight and support independent bookstores. They discuss the books they've written, the books they're reading now, and the art of storytelling. If you love books and you're curious about the writing world, you're in the right place.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Friends and Fiction Show. I'm Mary Kay Andrews.
I'm Christy Woodson Harvey.
And this is Friends and Fiction, four New York Times bestselling authors, endless stories to support indie bookstores, authors, and librarians. On this week's episode, Christy and I are thrilled to welcome New York Times bestselling author and Pulitzer Prize winning novelist Anna Quinlan to discuss her new novel, After Annie. The book was just released earlier this month, and we are so excited to speak with Anna about it.
But first, we have just a quick reminder to check out all the fun things going on in our Friends and Fiction community at friendsandfiction.com. There you'll find our show schedule, details on upcoming in-person events, and links to our bookshop.org page, to the Friends and Fiction official book club with Brenda and Lisa, to our merch store, and our book subscription box, which features Mary Kay's brand new Summers of the Saint and my forthcoming, well, both her forthcoming, not her brand new, and my forthcoming Happier Life. So make sure you check that out. And our weekly email newsletter sign up. In other words, if you want to know more about anything that Friends and Fiction offers, and we offer a lot, be sure to check out friendsandfiction.com.
Now let's welcome Anna Quinlan. Anna is a novelist and journalist whose work has appeared on fiction, nonfiction, and self-help bestseller list. She's the author of 10 novels, including Object Lessons, One True Thing, and Black and Blue. Her memoir, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, which was published in 2012, was a number one New York Times bestseller. Her book, A Short Guide to a Happy Life, has sold more than a million copies, and I'm sure almost every high school graduate or college graduate in the country has received a copy of that.
I got a copy when I graduated from high school. While a columnist at the New York Times, she won the Pulitzer Prize and published two collections, Living Out Loud and Thinking Out Loud. Her Newsweek columns were collected in Loud and Clear. Her new novel, After Annie, was released earlier this month, a Barnes & Noble March 2024 National Book Club selection. It is a hopeful story about how adversity can change us in profound ways. Sean, can you
bring Anna on?
Hey.
Hi, Anna.
We're so happy you're here.
Oh, Christy, so you saying that you got A Short Guide to a Happy Life for graduation made me feel as old as dirt.
Welcome to my world, Anna.
I'm so sorry. No, it is. It really, though, I mean, it is the perfect gift. I read it, of course, then and have read it several times since and have given it to so many people. It's just, it's the perfect thing. There's so much wisdom and so much insight, and everyone needs to have those rules to live by. I love it.
Well, thanks. Yeah. Next year is the 25th anniversary, and I think Random House is going to do something around that because people continue to resonate to the book.
That's so cool. I love that.
Absolutely. And we know why. Yeah. You know, Anna, you've examined so many facets of motherhood, from your New York Times public and private columns to so many of your novels. Catherine Newman's beautiful review of After Annie in the New York Times Book Review refer to you as our first lady of motherhood. Now that'll make you feel old, won't it? And also she called you an anthropologist of domesticity. After Annie is a story about a father and his four children picking up the pieces after the sudden death of Annie, the wife and mother. What drove you to examine motherhood from this perspective, that of a family living with the absence of the mother?
Honestly, my approach to this novel, which is my 10th, was completely different than any novel I've done before. Usually, I come to a book over a period of 4 to 6 months, and it's always in terms of envisioning a character. I'm power walking in the morning, and little by little, I begin to understand my protagonist. It's almost always a she, what she does for a living, what her birth order is, whether she has children, so on and so forth. And the story begins to coalesce as I begin to understand who the protagonist is. This was utterly different. I was power walking one morning, and I suddenly had a very vivid mental picture of a young woman, a wife and mother, standing in her shabby kitchen, dishing out mashed potatoes, getting a terrible pain in her head, and dropping the wooden spoon she was using and falling to the floor. And I just went with it. So odd that just came to me, and it is, in fact, as you probably know, the beginning of the book. And I discovered Annie, who I think is the most resonant character in the book, despite the fact that she dies in the first sentence. I discovered Annie in the same way over time through their memories of her that her husband, her daughter, and her best friend do.
That is so interesting. So it normally you have a little more of an idea where the story's going, and this time you were really feeling your way through as you went.
There was some of that, although because I was bound and determined, because of my feeling that the people we love become in some odd sense more real to us after they die than when they're around and we can take them for granted, I had this very clear sense that Annie was going to be the dominant character in the book. Okay. And that therefore, everything I saw with her husband and Allie, her daughter, and Anne Marie, her best friend, was going to be refracted in some sense through the lens of what they learned from Annie and what Annie's absence was doing to them in their daily lives.
That's so interesting. Well, we know that you lost your own mother at the age of 19, a striking loss for any young woman at any age. You've written quite a bit about grief and loss in your career. From One True Thing, your semi-autobiographical novel about a daughter caring for her dying mother, which was made into the movie starring Meryl Streep, to your new book, we've read that you've said After Annie has allowed you to close a chapter on your own mother's death. Will you talk to us about that journey in your writing culminating in your new book?
Well, I don't think that this book is in any sense autobiographical, except to the extent which both of you understand that all fiction is autobiographical, that everything you've ever experienced or seen, anyone you've known, gets ground up and spit out into the sausage that we're all making. What I do think is because this was about the loss of a really beloved person who was central to the lives of all these people. In my dedication continuum, it was the turn of my second daughter-in-law and her son. But I realized when I was done this book that the only person I could possibly dedicate it to was my mother. Mm-hmm. Because in some sense, it exemplified something that was kind of a touchstone of her life, which is 1 Corinthians and the line, love never fails. And so I put Azara and Jake on the back burner till the next book and dedicated this to my mother. And as I was doing it, I thought, in some sense, now we're done with that.
Interesting. That's incredible.
You know, in After Annie, you have such an unerring eye for the smallest detail. I keep thinking back to when Anne Marie tucks the bottle of rosé into the quilted satin blanket in the casket. Those just, I don't know, pointless details. And it reminds me of Rebecca Winter, the photographer protagonist of your novel, Still Life with Breadcrumbs, which is still one of my all-time favorite novels. I love that book so much. Do you think your journalism background is the source of that granular level of detail in your writing?
Absolutely. I mean, I wanted to be a novelist before I became a reporter. I wanted to be a novelist when I was a little girl. I would go into libraries and look around and think, yes, me next, you know, in that way that you do when you're young. Yeah. But I am I was so much better prepared to write fiction by having been a reporter first. I mean, you know, let me count the ways, and you know some of them. Yeah. I know how to write when I don't feel like writing.
Yeah.
That's really important. And it happens in a newsroom all the time. You're having a bad day, or, you know, the story isn't coalescing in your mind, but you better churn it out because there's a hole waiting to be filled with your story. Mm-hmm. I know how to write what I think is really credible dialogue.
Yes,
because I spent
definitely
so many years writing down the words of real people in my notebooks. Mm-hmm. And realizing over time that you could delineate someone's character by their syntax, by the words they chose, by how they put them together, almost more than describing them, that really could encapsulate a person. And I know how to write tight. I think, you know, every once in a while, my editor, Kate Medina at Random House, who's been my editor for all of my books, will say to me, "This paragraph is you in love with the sound of your own voice." her other line is, "Does it serve the reader?" And when I put those two things together, sometimes I come upon a paragraph, or she comes upon it and goes like whoosh with her pencil. I come upon a paragraph where I realize, like, oh, I really like that. That's really nicely written. And it stops the action of the book in its tracks. And that's why God invented the delete function. And finally, I think one of the things that I learned most convincingly from writing for newspapers was telling detail.
Yes.
Was finding those three or four details that grab the reader and pull them into the story. And I think I've used that over and over again as a novelist.
You definitely have. Mm-hmm. When you're describing Anna's kitchen, and when you're describing the furniture in that shabby house, I mean, you put us right there.
Yeah. But the books I love the most are the books that I feel like I live in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm living in them when I'm writing them. But when I'm reading other people's work, I hate look at me fiction. I hate the kind of novel that is relatively popular in some circles now, where I can feel the writer tap dancing. Look at me, look at me. Oh, isn't that clever? Isn't it interesting how? No, I don't want to see you. I want to be in the kitchen. I want to be in the living room. I want to be living in the book so that when I have to put it down, I sort of feel as though I've time traveled a little bit. Like, oh, yeah, here's where I was, and now I'm in my own den, you know. That's the kind of book that I want to write, and it's the kind of books I want to read.
Mm. Totally with you.
And that's very journalistic, you know, taking your own voice out of the story and making it all about the characters and the setting and dropping us into this completely different world. You do it masterfully.
There's no question though that voice is still there, and I'm always trying to communicate to kids.
For sure. I didn't mean that. Yeah. I just meant yes, for sure. You know you're reading an Anna Quinlan novel.
Well, that's what you hope. You hope that if you took your name off the cover, that certain readers would say, I recognize that.
For
and
sure.
And that's one of the things I try to communicate all the time to students, because I think particularly the smart ones feel like they have to have like some different narrative voice. Like it has to be kind of vaguely British, very grown up. And what I always want to say to them is, look, you know, there's nothing you can bring to this except for your own voice and your own personality. Yeah. So let that flag fly, because otherwise, you know, you're not going to be able to do anything that readers want to read.
That's yeah. True. Everything else is only a pale imitation of whoever it is that you're trying to be like.
Exactly.
And it's not maintainable. I mean, you can't maintain a voice that isn't your voice over 12 novels, 15 novels, 25 novels. Well,
I'm reading a biography of Carson McCullers that just came out. And One of the things that people say about her over and over again is that it's a completely distinct, unique way of looking at the world. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that I resonate to her novels because of that, because it's a way of looking at the world that's so far off my grid. Mm-hmm. But as a novelist, that is what you want people to say. This is a way of understanding the world that is thoroughly embedded in one individual. Mm.
Well, this was so interesting because this is something that the four of us who host Friends in Fiction have been joking about a lot lately, that we are going to do a series called Things That I'm Doing When I Should Be Writing. And so we loved reading in a recent PW interview with you that you are a procrastinator. I can't believe that. You said, I wake up early most mornings when it's still dark, then I go through my various rituals of not writing. I love that so much because we all have these own versions of maybe our stalling tactics, but I'd love it if you talk a little bit about your own process and about what keeps driving you to the page.
Maybe our stalling tactics? Are you kidding me? I am a world-class staller because every time I sit down, I am tormented by self-doubt, just tormented. Every time I sit down, I think nothing good can come of this. So the 4 mile power walk is oddly enough almost writing. Yeah. It certainly is when a lot of the work gets done. It's hard to tell. I remember I was walking in Riverside Park one day really fast, and this nice man pulled up next to me and said, "Can I join you?" And I said, "No, I'm working." And he sort of looked at me and then kept on going. But I really was working. I was in the middle of puzzling out something about characters. But all the other stuff, you know, I mean, I read a whole lot of newspapers and I talk to my best friend on the telephone. It's all designed to keep me from having to sit down, except that at a certain point, I run out of things to do. And I do, in fact, sit down at the computer and begin.
You know, that reminds me of a story. Years ago, I've lived in the same neighborhood for like 37 years. And I was walking one day down by a lake and a neighbor pulled up beside me in the car and said, "Why aren't you working on the next book?" And I was coming back, "I am."
Exactly. There's so much that goes on during your moving around process that people really wouldn't believe. You know, the beginnings of whole scenes and the relationships between characters and so on and so forth. A lot happens when I'm power walking. A fair amount happens when I'm in the car. And a fair amount happens when I'm cooking. Yeah. You know, sort of rote tasks that allow part of my brain to go somewhere else.
Definitely.
Interesting. Ever notice that how you feel affects your food choices and that what you eat affects how you feel throughout the day? Well, researchers noticed it too, and now there's cutting-edge science about how food affects our emotional well-being. I'm food and science journalist Mary Beth Albright, and in my weekly podcast, Eat, You'll Feel Better, I look at practical, realistic ways to put the science of eating for emotional well-being into action. And, this is important, without lapsing into negative diet culture messages that can really ruin anyone's emotional well-being. We talk about things like how the food in your gut sends messages directly to your brain. And we also celebrate something that I personally find often missing from food health news, and that's leaning into pleasure. Because food is delicious, and it's not just about what we eat. Emotional well-being is also about how we eat. So join me every week on Eat You'll Feel Better, where we use science to improve mood through food.
Ready to age awesome? Pop in your AirPods and join me, Katie Fogarty, over on A Certain Age Podcast, an age-positive podcast that helps you live your best evolving midlife loud and proud. We know the only constant is change. Kids grow, jobs come and go. What it takes to be fit, healthy, happy, fulfilled in midlife looks way different than it did in our 20s and 30s. A Certain Age features expert voices and real women 40, 50, 60, and beyond with tips, tools, and resources to help with the hard stuff, menopause, aging parents, career change, and light you up about what's next. Each week, we talk wellness, beauty, family, money, purpose, fashion, and fun in frank, funny interviews that go straight to the heart of issues facing women. One Apple Podcast review says, "Each episode is a gold mine of ideas, emotional support, and self-discovery. I feel like I'm part of the conversation at the best dinner party imaginable." A Certain Age Podcast. Live midlife out loud.
So in 1990, you became only the third woman ever to be given a regular column on the New York Times op-ed page. Since then, your stories, whether it's your journalism, your fiction, or your many works of nonfiction, have focused in large part on feminism, motherhood, and family life. Has it been a conscious choice to center women in your work, Anna? And why are women's stories and roles so important to you as a writer?
Well, first of all, my whole life has been made possible by second wave feminism. I mean, there's no question about it. When I was a little girl, I was a little tormented by the sense that there wasn't a whole lot of room in the world for someone like me. In my neighborhood, there were only two career paths for women. One was mother of seven, and the other was none. And I was not cut out to be a nun. And I didn't know at the time that motherhood was going to play such a large role in my life, although not as a mother of seven, but as a mother of three. And then when I was in high school, the world began to change for women and sort of broke open. And the end result is that every year on her birthday, I send an email to Gloria Steinem and say, "Thank you for my life." And the other people that I need to thank are the six women who brought suit against the New York Times in a class action suit that led the Times to hire a whole mess of women at once. And I was one of them when I was 24 years old. So feminism has loomed very large in my life and in my work, in part because at the time that I was made an op-ed page columnist, I was the only woman on the page. All my colleagues were male. And I remember an editor who shall remain unidentifiable taking me to lunch and saying, "You know, you should avoid writing about women's stuff because you'll kind of get typecast." And I said, "My name's Anna. I'm already typecast." But I think the other thing that he was ignoring was, first of all, if you're given that valuable a piece of journalistic real estate, you have a moral imperative to, as H.L. Mencken said, afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. But the second part of it was that those were the issues that weren't getting covered by my colleagues. My colleagues weren't writing about reproductive rights. My colleagues weren't writing very much about people who didn't have homes to go to or people who couldn't feed their kids or the issues surrounding raising children for so many women. We had a vast panoply of readers at the New York Times who felt somewhat disenfranchised by the paper, despite the fact that it was called The Great Gray Lady. And suddenly there was someone writing about their stuff, and they really responded to that. So I sort of felt like I had the responsibility to write about a lot of these issues, and I wasn't going to drop the ball on it.
Are you ever tempted these days with what's going on in our world to try to write a write and publish an op-ed to bring your voice, your editorial voice back into the fray?
Well, there's two parts to that answer. The first part is that a primal scream is not a good starting point for a column. But the second point, and I can't say this enough, I'm 71 years old. When I started on the op-ed page, I was 36. That's who I want writing columns. I want the 36-year-old who's living a life that I haven't led, who's seen things that I haven't seen, to have that piece of real estate now. Because I really feel, and it has never been clearer than during this presidential race, the baby boomers have clogged the leadership pathways in every single area of American life. And there are a lot of really smart, capable 40 and 50-year-olds waiting for their turn to write, to lead, to run companies, who are being stymied by people in their 70s and 80s, who, some of whom, God bless them, have to continue to work. Some of them, like me, who have a job where I can do it until the day I die. But some of whom, particularly in politics and punditry, need to step aside for the next generation. I mean, it was in his inaugural speech, as we all remember, JFK said, "The torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans, and I wish it would be passed in Washington now."
Hear, hear.
Wow, that's so well said. Well, Anna, you have written a book called How Reading Changed My Life. So we'd be remiss not to ask you one of our favorite questions here on Friends in Fiction. What were the values around reading and writing in your family when you were growing up, and how did that shape you as a writer?
I wouldn't say it was so much in my family. My father, like most men, tended to read history and biography and not fiction. And my mother had 5 children over the space of 10 years and was very busy as a full-time mom. But we had a family friend who we called Aunt Gert. And Aunt Gert had been an only child in a very prosperous household. And in her basement was what looked like a mid-sized lending library, one book after another after another. And she would let me go down there and take books from there. That's the first, when I first read Little Women, it was her copy. When I first found the Betsy Tacy books by Maud Hart Lovelace. I know, right? So here's the deal with the Betsy Tacy books. When I mention them, 90% of people look at me blankly, and the other 10% make a noise like you just made. They're kind of this hidden secret, but they're the most wonderful books about being a girl. And well, no, not about just about being a girl, because I currently am reading them at bedtime with my 7-year-old grandson, Arthur. Aww. And we just finished Betsy Tacy, the first one, and now we're going to Betsy Tacy and Tib, and he's loving them. Aww. So I got those from Aunt Gert, the Girl of the Limberlost, which nobody reads anymore, The Yearling, all of these classic books. Yeah. And I really did. I mean, as I said, I was a little girl who wasn't quite sure where I was going to fit in. And the thing about reading is it takes you somewhere else, and it enlarges your world. And you read, you know, you read a book like the Betsy Tacy books, and Betsy wants to be a writer. She hasn't, in the early books, she's just telling all her friends' stories. But pretty soon, Betsy wants to be a writer. Her family expects that she will be a writer. And because we have the books in our hands, we know she has become a writer. And that was so powerful to me as a little girl. I mean, except for hanging out with my kids and my grandkids, reading is by a long shot my favorite thing in the whole world to do.
Yeah. I can remember I came to the Betsy Tacy books, the later ones, as an adult with grown children. And I remember discovering the ones where she is a writer, and she's, you know, there's a war on, and her love interest is writing. And I thought, gosh, those books really have such value.
You know what she does so brilliantly that I wasn't quite as clear on as I should have been because of reading Betsy Tacy aloud with Arthur. Betsy Tacy and Betsy Tacy and Tib are written at probably a middle school level. And the books get more complex.
They do.
In terms of the reading level, as Betsy gets older, gets to high school, Betsy in Spite of Herself is one of my favorites, which is the book where Betsy falls for some guy who's by the standards of their town, rich, and suddenly starts to wear perfume and put an E at the end of her name and everything, and can't manage it. So what you said about voice, she can't keep it up over the long haul because she's just Betsy. But that trick of being able to write the earlier books in this kind of middle school fashion and then getting more and more complex. I mean, you know, as a writer, you know, that's kind of a hat trick.
Yeah, it definitely is. And speaking of hat tricks, you've written a little bit of everything from opinion columns to memoir, novels to books on the writing craft, from children's book to memoir. So what's up next from Anna Quinlan?
Oh, as you know, it used to take 10 to 12 months between finishing and locking up a book and having it hit the shelves. Now it's more like 16 to 18 months for a lot of us. So as soon as I have a manuscript that's done and dusted, sometimes I give myself 2 or 3 weeks, but I start another one. So I'm about halfway through a new novel.
Can you talk about it at all?
I always feel like they're so squishy at this point. But once again, I mean, female friendship is a big part of it. And in this one, so is motherhood, but to the extent that the protagonist of the book, it's told in the first person, wants to have children and is having some difficulty.
Well, we will be waiting with bated breath, so get back to writing as soon as we're finished. If we see you in Riverside Park, we will not stop to walk with you.
Well, you won't, because let's see, I'm going to Vermont and Tennessee and Florida. And you guys know the drill. I mean, I'm on book tour. So yeah. My time is not my own.
It's not your right. No. Well, we were getting ready to ask you about that in just a second. But if you would stick around, we have one more question, or maybe two more questions for you at the end. But first, a few quick reminders to our listeners and viewers out there.
For all of you watching, listening, now that you've had the pleasure of meeting Anna, we encourage you to rush out and buy your copies of After Annie. The perfect place to do that is in our Friends in Fiction shop on bookshop.org. You'll be getting it a discount and helping to fund our show, all while supporting our beloved independent booksellers nationwide.
And Anna.
And here's the book once again, just so you have it to see. And we also want to remind you to follow us on Instagram and join our Facebook group, which is nearly 250,000 members strong. So when you talk about the power of books and reading, that's 250,000 people who have found Friends in Fiction. When you visit friendsinfiction.com, you can stay abreast of upcoming Friends in Fiction show guests, in-person events, shop our merch store, order our book subscription box, and sign up for our weekly email newsletter, which is chock full of bonus content.
If you love Friends in Fiction, we hope you'll leave a rating or review and remember to tell a friend. If you subscribe to our YouTube channel, you can catch all our back episodes and never miss a thing. And when you subscribe to our podcast, you can take us with you wherever you go.
Okay, Anna, maybe two more questions. We talk a lot on our show about how writers shape their books, but I'd love to ask you the inverse now. How do you think writing this book shaped you?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. And, you know, I keep thinking about the fact that when I wrote the first draft of the book, I understood that there were very emotional parts of the book, but I didn't really feel it. I almost intellectualized it in order to get it down on the page. And then when I did the revisions, I kept crying. It reminded me of, there's a famous quote from Robert Frost, "No tears in the writer, no tears in the reader." And I kept thinking, well, okay, if that's true. I think it enabled me to think a lot about how important it is to cherish people while they're still with you. I mean, as I said, you know, I'm 71 years old, and the worst part about getting older is that your friends start to die. And so we all need to pay attention while people are there, even though they're going to live on so vividly in our hearts and minds. I think it also made me think a lot about female friendship. You know, the friendship between Annie and Anne Marie is really one of the bedrocks of this book. And I sort of feel like Anne Marie's loss of a lifelong friend is a really kind of distinct loss that doesn't get reflected enough. We know how hard it will be for Annie's husband and certainly for her 13-year-old daughter. But Anne Marie will never have another friend like that. And that's really tragic.
Yeah. It's so true. Well, Anna, you touched on this just a little bit, but would you let everyone know how they can connect with you online and on the road in the coming weeks?
Well, my tour schedule is on Instagram. I never thought I'd be on Instagram, but I am now, and I love it because there's a lot of Labrador Retriever content. Yeah. But my Instagram is at Anna Q Writes. That's the one with the little blue check next to it. And then the schedule's also on Anna Quinlan, all one word, .net.
Amazing.
Well, Anna, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you today. I know Christy and I have been really looking forward to this so much. Thanks so much for being with us on the Friends in Fiction show.
And thanks. This was really simple and easy. It was like just sitting around talking. We all should have cups of coffee.
I know. I wish we could do it more. I have like 1,000 other things I could ask you, but we'll save you.
Too.
We'll save you. But everyone out there, be sure to tune in next week for when Kristen and Ron will be welcoming Allison Pataki to discuss her new novel, Finding Margaret Fuller. That show will air on the Friends in Fiction Facebook page and YouTube channel on Wednesday, March 27th at 7 p.m. Eastern, and it will be posted to our podcast for your listening pleasure on Friday, March 29th. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You can join us every week on Facebook or YouTube, where our live show airs on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Also, subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram. We're so glad you're here.